Coming up on Let's Clear the Air.
Our dependence on the grid is increasing, and the grid's vulnerability is increasing due to these separate, you know, weather incidents. Not to mention just the aging nature of the grid.
Welcome to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. Conversations focused on how some of the world's top energy leaders are innovating to deliver clean, affordable, and reliable energy for the future. Your hosts are energy and climate expert Dr. Andrew Parker and midstream industry veteran Adam Murray. Now, here are Andrew and Adam.
Welcome to the Let's Clear the Air Podcast. I'm Andrew Parker alongside Adam Murray. Today, we're going to be talking about the nation's electric grid, which continues to get a lot of attention this summer as we experience extreme heat waves across the South. So we're going to get some perspective on grid reliability and the move to renewables from an industry expert with decades of experience on economic policy related to electric transmission and power markets.
Our guest today is Rob Gramlich, who is the founder and president of the consultancy Grid Strategies. The company helps its clients understand opportunities and barriers to integrating clean energy into the electric grid. Rob is also the co-founder of the nonprofit Americans for a Clean Energy Grid. Rob has a long history of expertise in the grid and renewables industries. For many years, he's held a number of leadership positions with the American Wind Energy Association. He was the economic advisor to the Federal Energy Regulatory Chairman, Pat Wood, from 2001 to 2005. Very, very good position there. And he testifies frequently before the United States Congress, FERC, and the U.S. Department of Energy, the state legislatures, and regulatory commission. So Rob is a very busy guy. Rob, it's great to have you. Welcome to Let's Clear the Air.
Thanks, Adam. Great to be with you.
All right, Rob, let's clear the air. We like to start with an icebreaker, and I know you're an endurance athlete, and so let's clear the air. Swimming, running, or biking, what is your preferred endurance sport?
Gotta say, I love a good long trail run. That's my favorite thing to do, and especially with a good podcast, like maybe this one.
Awesome. I'm doing the triple bypass this weekend, 120 miles on a bike here in Colorado.
Nice.
And so I would say bike. Adam, what about you?
I don't run unless people are chasing me and I sink in the water. So I got to say bike as well.
Oh man, that's awesome. That's a great answer. Awesome, Rob. We appreciate the time to talk a little bit about the grid, and maybe just to kick off the conversation, tell us a little bit about Grid Strategies, what you do, and what your role in the world of electricity is.
Sure. I started Grid Strategies about 6 years ago. We focus on bulk power markets, mostly US, do a little international work, power markets and transmission, which are kind of the bulk power system things you need. And we focus a lot on the clean energy transition and how you're going to get a reliable, affordable supply and make all the pieces work together. And we got a team of 8 people, engineers, economists, and policy people, mostly in the DC area.
Excellent. So maybe the first question that pops into my head right now is, with how hot things are this summer, you know, I think since the 2021 Texas winter storm, there's been a lot of conversation about grid reliability, and the heat this summer is, you know, furthering that discussion. And so, you know, spend a couple of minutes and maybe talk about, like, is the attention warranted? How reliable is the grid today? Where are the biggest risk areas that you see that probably need the most attention immediately?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think we start out with a basically reliable grid. You know, for those listeners who've traveled around the world, you know, what we have here in the US is still kind of a marvel and pretty strong. But I'd say it's the severe weather incidents that are recently causing people to question and make sure our systems are set up. It's severe cold is, you know, has been an issue. Obviously, Winter Storm Uri and Elliott, and then severe heat, like we're seeing in, you know, Texas today, or really much of the country this summer, or California's had its episodes. So, you know, what can just what happens is a generation of all sorts are sort of vulnerable to different things. And so that's why, I think we're going to talk some about transmission, but that's why I sort of view transmission as the best insurance policy, because there's always available power somewhere. You just have to go a little bit away, and usually with some transmission a few states away, you can, you know, get power available to cover any shortfall.
Excellent. I mean, we've heard, we brought up the heat that's going on this week or this month, right, or this summer. But it's, you know, it's really been a boom for solar, right, and its generation activity. So how big of a factor has that been on the growth of solar that you're seeing, you know, here just real short term, but also, you know, with the increased demand for need to cool and things like that, how much of that is solar activity?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, these summer incidents are, you know, it's getting hot, prolonged heat, that obviously runs more air conditioning. And we're seeing parts of the country get air conditioning that didn't used to have it. So that means like a lot of summer afternoon power demand that's being added to the system, and solar is excellent for that. Right now, this summer, 2023, solar is doing great in Texas with some of the heat waves. Solar paired with batteries, even though they're what people call short duration batteries, the lithium ion that might last 4 hours, you know, that's enough to cover, you know, into much of the evening. So you get solar through the afternoon and the batteries through much of the evening when you're doing most of the air conditioning. That's really working well. It works well in California. California's taking advantage of that. System was, you know, much more reliable this past year than previous years in California with all the solar and storage that came in. And so Texas is seeing that as well. The desert Southwest is getting that same dynamic. So, yeah, it's really been great to see that solar and storage for these summer incidents have really been coming together. And, you know, we still need the firm backup of gas generation in most places, or maybe all of the U.S. You know, that's there as well. But with the solar and storage, it's allowing a little bit less of the, you know, fast ramping that can stress some of the plants. So it takes a little bit of the burden off of the ramping on some of the other generation that you need on the system.
Sure, sure. Well, we know your background's, you know, economics, finance, that you've helped out with on some of this stuff. And, you know, Grid Strategies helps their clients with low cost decarbonization, right? So what's really the key to affordable? I mean, you bring up California. I'm here in Dallas. Andrew's in Colorado. A lot of times when I think California, I think more expensive. So what's really the key to, like, you know, making all of this affordable for the middle of the U.S.?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I look at it as portfolios, and there's like an affordable portfolio, kind of a sweet spot that you could put together. In most places, there's plenty of solar. In most places, there's plenty of wind. Those are pretty cheap to get zero carbon, low cost energy in terms of megawatt hours. Now, you know, you need other, let's call them firm resources that are on the system and available and dispatchable as well. And you can sort of put that portfolio together. And then transmission and storage are the other parts of the package. And I think every region is looking at some combination of those resources above, with depending on the region, a little bit more of one versus another, more wind, more solar. And the, you know, the batteries serve a purpose, but we don't really have long duration batteries yet. We're starting to get some. new technologies in, but most of them are short duration. So, I think it is kind of an economic and, physical engineering analysis for each system of what's that affordable portfolio. And I personally think transmission is a big part of that. Transmission can get you access to low cost resources. A lot of the good wind and solar sites are far from the population centers. So there's kind of a balance, like a kind of a co-optimization between, maybe you don't get the cheapest, super remote wind and solar, but when you factor in the delivered cost of generation plus transmission costs, then there's kind of an optimum point there. And that's a lot of the analysis like that we do in different utility proceedings, integrated resource planning, or in the regional transmission planning processes around the country.
Excellent.
I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, about the casual listener who's going to turn this podcast on. And maybe the question we should have started with, and not to backtrack the conversation, but why should, to the casual listener who might not know, why should we care about the grid? What's wrong with the grid, right? Like, hey, I flip on my lights at my house every day and they come on. So maybe kind of frame this discussion now with like the why do we care and what are the problems with the grid today that we need to overcome?
Yeah. Well, I think it really is the severe weather incidents. And the thing about severe weather, both extreme hot and cold, is not only is the grid most vulnerable then, but like if your power goes out, you're really stuck. And so it was horrifying to everybody to see literally people dying during winter storm Uri in Texas. But it's also not hard to imagine that happening elsewhere. So I think we need to kind of think about holistically, first of all, what's the backup plan? Like, stuff happens, right? Whether it's like physical attack, cyber attack, severe weather. So like, we all need to have some kind of backup plan if the grid does go down, whether it's resilience centers in your neighborhood, things like that, or just your own on-site if your, F-150 Lightning can take care of you. There are a lot of options there. But also, how do we make sure the grid is as strong as it can be? And so there's different threats to the grid. California or around the West, they've had wildfires, right? Those are threats to the grid. Again, those winter storms were more threats to the generation. And that's where, a stronger grid can be the insurance policy because there's always generation available somewhere if you can get to it with transmission. But everybody wants a reliable system. And most people, you're right. Most people just don't care. They don't really want to care about the details of the grid. They want to flip the switch and, they might pay attention to the different rates they're getting at different times and things like that. But otherwise, they don't want to have to, worry about it. So, I think it's the utility industry's job to just make sure it works for everybody.
Yeah, maybe to summarize for the listeners, it's all about minimizing interruption, right? As you become more and more reliant in an electrified world, it's about minimizing the interruptions and the downtime that you experience at your business or your home or wherever without electricity, right? And those blackouts right now and those interruptions are becoming more frequent and broader in their geography, right? So it's funny. I saw a photo online the other day and it was a picture of Matthew McConaughey from a movie and he's looking at like a computer screen and it was just captioned like ERCOT trying to convince Texans that 95 is room temperature, right? Yeah. Because of how hot it's been. it was pretty funny actually. So, thinking about that, kind of how do we minimize interruptions? And I wanted to ask you, like, what are the biggest challenges that are facing the grid today? What are the priorities or what should be the priorities to address them to ensure that in the coming, 1, 5, 10 years, we're making progress on minimizing the interruptions we experience with electricity and improving grid reliability, right? Because we're moving, I don't think people appreciate how reliant they are on the grid. And as you electrify your life, you're only becoming that much more dependent on the grid. So this is a huge topic that probably not enough people appreciate.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, because it's happening simultaneously. Our dependence on the grid is increasing for all those reasons, and the grid's vulnerability is increasing due to these separate, you know, weather incidents, et cetera. Not to mention just the aging nature of the grid. I mean, most of the grid was built, most of the physical assets, like if you go look at the average transmission tower or transformer, you know, it's 60, 70 years old. It's when we built it, and we're kind of due for a replacement, just like if, you know, our air conditioner or heater or furnace or, you know, major capital parts of our, you know, house are due for replacement, you know, or when your car dies after 12 years, you got to buy a new car. Like, that's the year you got to put up some money, and, you know, it sucks and you wish you didn't have to do it then, but it's like, well, got to do it. So we got that replacement, we got the severe weather, and we also have significant demand growth overall we haven't talked about yet, which is really interesting, because the industry in the, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s was used to, you know, 5% load growth. It cut back in the 80s and 90s to sort of 2 or 3% load growth. Kind of looked like economic or GDP growth, like, oh, it's going to be 2 or 3% over a year. Then we got to a point right at the turn of the century where compact fluorescence and then LED lights came in, and then power demand flattened for like 20 years. It was just the same every year. But now we're at this, like, suddenly in this growth mode again because of a few things. One, we want to manufacture chips in this country. That's big power demand. We want to drive electric vehicles. That's big power demand. Our data centers that are powering the internet and everything we're doing electronically, those are huge power demand sources. Artificial intelligence puts that on steroids. If you think of all the calculations that AI is doing day in, day out, as it, you know, teaches itself things from available information, it's just cranking through information and algorithms. So all these things are putting all this power demand on. So we got to focus on the grid. And then we all know that the constraints on the grid in terms of, like, developing new lines are hard. Everybody knows that it's just hard to build a new transmission line going across three states or something like that. So that's not the only thing we need to do. And there's some alternatives to that. But, like, you know, that is kind of the grid. That is, like, the guts of the grid. And we do need new capacity.
Well, yeah, that I was going to bring that up with you. I mean, I've read the book Superpower by Russell Gold, and have had the opportunity to meet Michael Skelly in person, who I'm sure you're aware of if you're working with transmission lines. But I recommend everyone go check out the book. But, you know, along with transmission being difficult, you know, to do interstate, especially, you know, I've also heard about an increase, and we've had a guest talk about an increase in solar projects being rejected by local governments or you know, state governments. So, you know, what are you seeing an impact on that, or is there just, you know, I've also heard there's a lot of projects that are just waiting to connect. So, what's sort of the real story there from your perspective?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Skelly is a good friend, and he's great, a great kind of leader in this industry. And he's back at it again, trying to build big, long lines across multiple states, which was the subject of that book. Great book by Russell Gold. And it's easy, you know, fun weekend read.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, that was kind of a story of, you know, just how hard it is to get alignment for long linear infrastructure, right? Like, it's one thing to build a generation project or any kind of, I don't know, LNG facility, any other, like, single point type of infrastructure. But if you have to string together, you know, hundreds of parcels of land across one long line and make sure it's all contiguous so your line can connect, that's just an extra degree of difficulty. And so that's where transmission gets real hard. I mean, it might be on the average landowner might be thrilled to just take a lease payment and have a, you know, a line strung up over their farm. They can still farm on the land. All they have to do is look at the transmission line, but they're making money from it. And that's great if, you know, the average, you know, landowner is happy with that. Right. But the reality is, you know, all it takes is a few and like a particular choke point that you have to get through to block a line. So that's hard. I mean, you know, there is progress, all those developers, there's a bunch of them, there's about a half dozen like that, that are active around the country. You know, they're making progress with their lines. But every once in a while, they, you know, they need some regulatory decisions to get through choke points. And then you mentioned solar projects. Yeah, it's been unfortunate lately to see kind of the, it gets into kind of the partisan nature sometimes of things in our culture and, you know, rural versus urban culture and, you know, the information sources that people are getting and the different areas that, you know, sometimes, I don't know, there's been a lot of like negative solar and renewable messaging that, that people see that I don't subscribe to. The rational side of it is, you know, sure, every piece of land is dear to somebody and, you know, people right. care not just if they own the land, but what's happening in their community. And that's all legitimate. And, you know, solar and renewable developers have to take that into account and work with communities. And there's usually community benefit, you know, agreements and arrangements and things like that. And that's sort of par for the course. It's just unfortunate that it's getting harder due to, I think, some disinformation that's getting out and just because, you know, energy is kind of getting partisan. Everything's getting partisan in the country. So right. it's getting tough.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we've had a couple guests bring it up and it's just really interesting. I mean, Dr. Scott Tinker was on one of our recent episodes and, you know, he sort of believes that in general, all energy is good energy. I think he talked about your sort of menu in different regions as well. So nice to know there's a lot of like-minded people out there trying to solve some complex problems.
So if I can piggyback off that thought, because it seems kind of like the right time to ask. So I spent some time in D.C. last week with folks from the EPA, EDF was there, Department of Energy, and I came away with a surprisingly refreshing view on how things like this are being tackled and addressed in D.C. And I felt a bit more bipartisanship than I maybe might have perceived from the mainstream media. So, you know, maybe, you know, I don't think we care to get too deep into the politics, but maybe talk about some of the, you know, the support. Where are you getting support on the grid in DC, since that's where you're talking to us from? And do you feel like there is some or more bipartisanship on this topic coming together, or is it still pretty polarized?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting on transmission. Generally, it's supported by both sides of the aisle, sort of in theory. It breaks down sometimes on the specific policies. And it's interesting, you know, I was involved 20 years ago, there was a flurry of policy legislation and FERC activity, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, around transmission. And it was really kind of Republican led at that time. I was working for, you know, Bush's appointed chair, Pat Wood, as a majority Republican FERC. And then people like Republican Senator Domenici in the Senate Energy Committee, and then the Bush team like Jimmy Clausfelty at Department of Energy, David Hill and others, like they were kind of leading all these initiatives for these big transmission policy issues. And a lot of those policy initiatives are the same today, but it's reversed in terms of political support. The Democrats figured out over the last, really just the last 2-3 years, how important transmission was for clean energy integration, because Adam, you mentioned all the projects lined up in the interconnection queues. But the basic issue is there is like all the clean energy wants to get on the grid, but we have limited grid capacity. Mm-hmm. So it can't get on. So I think all the Democrats have realized that situation. And so now all the Democrats are, I think, without exception, in strong support of significant transmission buildout from the progressives to the moderates. So that's kind of interesting. But Republicans had not been really involved in these issues for the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years. And so there wasn't this sort of, you know, kind of acquired wisdom on, like, what's our Republican transmission policy? It was just, there was nothing there. But they suddenly saw in the last, you know, couple of years, oh, all the Democrats are prioritizing this. Maybe that's not our thing, or, you know. I think they're only just kind of coming to the table now to say, all right, what's the deal here? You know, the average Republican on the Hill is maybe coming in a little bit skeptical. If the Democrats are pushing so hard, like, what's, you know, what's in it for my people I care about versus the people you care about? But they are coming to the table and they're asking all the right questions. There's a lot of members on the Republican side who are open to, you know, good conversations about it. So I guess I'm optimistic that we can get to a good point. The challenge has been sort of the timing. Like, we had these, you know, IIJA, the infrastructure law, and the IRA, the, you know, the tax credits for clean energy. Those both, like, had some transmission pieces that were considered, but some of it dropped out, and we kind of wound up with actually barely anything on transmission from those two pieces. It was
interesting.
Kind of a long story. It's a little bit late to the party. Even though a lot of the news stories around those laws did talk about, quote unquote, the grid, when it was talking about the grid, it was really more about, like, you know, CCS, hydrogen, wind, solar, storage, like incentives for generation, right, not so much transmission per se. So we, you know, here we sit now after we had those windows for legislation, you know, open and then quickly shut. You know, we, you know, some stuff got passed, but transmission didn't get included. And now I just kind of fear, you know, we might have missed the legislative windows. Those don't open very often, and you never know when they're going to open again. So, you know, we got to keep doing all the work to, you know, educate and do a lot of bipartisan cross the aisle communications. I don't do a lot of that. I don't lobby really personally much, but, you know, I know a lot of folks are doing that type of work. So there's a potential for bipartisan. And as you noted, Andrew, a lot of times in the private meetings, there's a lot more bipartisan agreement than you would see from reading the press. You know, the boring, let's get along and get stuff done, doesn't usually get reported as much as the drama.
Rob, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in just a moment.
This podcast is brought to you by Let's Clear the Air, a public education campaign of GPA Midstream Association and GPSA Midstream Suppliers. The midstream industry helps power the lives of 330 million Americans by working around the clock to provide reliable energy, counteract climate change, and strengthen our country's economy. Let's Clear the Air is about promoting a constructive dialogue on the future of energy. Learn more and join the conversation at letscleartheairnow.org. Now, back to Andrew and Adam.
You've been an expert on the grid and renewable energy for a long time. In the big scheme of things, you know, two-part question, is a 100% renewable grid realistic? I mean, you know, if so, what time frame would that take to get there, in your opinion? And then also, is there a place where these long transmission lines and these long natural gas or crude oil pipelines could come together and sort of share some of that right away? Has that been explored in your purview?
Yeah. So first on the target, I like to talk about 80% clean, or renewable, you know, maybe 60-80% renewable and some nuclear as like a clean portfolio. 100% is hard. There are places that can do it. You know, and they're usually super sunny places without long, dark winters, you know, or they're places with a lot of hydro, which can really help to sort of balance and, you know, be a big battery, essentially. But there's a lot of places in the country that don't have that. So I like to talk about 80%, and let's get to 80 and let's figure out the rest later. And maybe there's new technologies then that can come in. And the main thing is we need sort of a firm backup source that's there as available. And for the foreseeable future, we're gonna have to rely on that as well. So it's a portfolio, yeah. But you can reduce the capacity factor of those units, the hours of operation, and the emissions, the local and the carbon emissions. So I think that's a reliable, affordable portfolio we can get to. We can worry about the harder, the last 20% later, yeah. and work on other sectors. And then in terms that you mentioned right away and pipelines and transmission, I'm not actually aware of a pipeline and a transmission line in the same corridor. I don't really see why you couldn't, but, so it might be done, but I'm not really aware of it. I do think a lot of the policies are similar. There's certainly a lot of bipartisan interest in making permitting easier generally. And I think there's a lot of folks on the left side of the aisle, on the Democratic side, who think that really most of what we're going to be building is going to be clean mm-hmm. generation and clean and the transmission for it. So even if permitting processes get easy for everything, it's going to be an environmental net benefit, even if some fossil gets built. So I think there's a pretty broad achievable consensus for, that general concept. That obviously the details matter and the specifics, and there's interest groups all over the map, and Washington is hard enough to get anything done in, so I'm not saying anything's a high probability. I'm just saying there's room for deals.
Yeah, it's a complicated solution, right?
Yep.
So you hear a lot about baseload power, and you kind of mentioned it, right? I mean, I hear a lot about wind and solar cannot be a base load energy. I think what underlies a lot of that is the issue of storage, right? So maybe if you could explore that idea of, can wind and solar at some point be base load energies? And what would it take to achieve that?
Sure. So first of all, it's important to think about this question in a system way, like the whole power system across many states, because that's all really one integrated machine, as opposed to like a specific wind or solar project timeframe. Like any given wind project, the wind might, gust up and calm down and whatever. And that's really not a problem, because in the aggregate across 8 states in a region or something, the wind is always blowing somewhere. And so wind as an aggregate power source is providing an overall steady supply. And that's what the system needs, again, since it's all really one machine and the electrons are traveling at the speed of light across those 8 states. Mm-hmm. So at first you got to get your head in the regional system mindset. And then you think about, okay, well, we know the sun's going to go down every single night, right? So first of all, you have predictable patterns. So it's the whole problem is a lot easier when you can predict what's happening, and we can actually do wind forecasts, and we know when cloud cover is going to come through, and the systems and tools are getting better for that. But then you get to, when you study the problem, you find that, most times you can get most of your power from the aggregate renewables. You put the wind and solar together, and if you have geothermal, great. And, nuclear adds some clean, not renewable, but carbon-free power. And then you can get to these, high numbers of aggregate penetration. But then you often also have to be realistic and look at kind of the patterns and say, there's been repeated instances of 3 to 5 days without very much wind or sun. And it often happens in the winter. So what are you going to do? You're going to need something there. Sure, there's a lot of things you can do on the demand side, but you know, our society's tolerance for a whole lot on the demand side is limited, and the regulatory processes are really difficult for getting a lot on the demand side. So then you're looking at, all right, what's the supply option to sort of be there and fill those gaps? And natural gas, I think, is the main source that people think will be there for the foreseeable future for those times, gas plants, and they need to have the gas obviously available. And that can work. And just, you know, any other sort of firm source, existing units or new units that might not operate a whole lot. And that's the thing from an environmental perspective is like, why should one care that much about units that are just there and available mm-hmm. if they barely ever operate and they're barely ever producing local or global emissions? I think we need to make a bit of a shift to kind of say, you know, power plant availability is really important. And if they're mm-hmm. there and exist, that in itself is not a problem. It's the, you know, if you're running them day in and day out and, you know, contributing to ozone and smog in a city, yeah, that's a problem. But like, if they're just there and available for, you know, backup use, that's not a problem. So that's the
insurance,
you know. Yeah, that's a generation insurance policy. And
I heard you mention nuclear too earlier. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's another one, right, that I think is going to have a renaissance at some point.
Well, we have all these existing nukes that are old and big contributors day in and day out to carbon free energy. There's a question for whoever's got to pay the bill about, you know, how much investment is needed to keep them going or the relicensing. So it's not free, but it's certainly an important option. And yeah, nobody should close a nuclear plant, or no state should allow it to be closed without at least thinking about how do we keep this thing going. So is that, and then the new nukes like SMRs, the smaller modular reactors are a really intriguing opportunity. And one thing that's really neat about them is you could put them on the site of, an old power plant that might've closed or might be closing soon. And they've already got the interconnect, right? Because we were talking before about the limited grid capacity for interconnection. Well, if you use that same site, that's a nice benefit.
Yeah. I one thing I learned about last week was some of the work that the DOE is doing with the small modular reactors. Yep. And that's actually really exciting. I got one more question for you, and I think Adam will wrap us up. But I know that in addition to your work with grid strategies, you're the co-founder of a nonprofit, Americans for Clean Energy Grid. And you guys just released a regional report card on transmission planning and development, and a good portion of the country was scored pretty low. So, maybe talk about, you know, what regions scored well, what regions didn't score well, and maybe what do you hope that report card accomplishes?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I was sort of the lead on that study. So there's sort of a basic thing that every region should be doing that most regions are not yet doing, which is let's look out 10 or 20 years and make a reasonable estimate of the future added generation and the future retired generation and the load forecast, the demand, and put that together in a transmission plan. Just literally connect the dots between the generation and the load. That should be a normal job of any transmission planner. In periods of our industry history, that's been a routine function. It's not rocket science. There's, clear methods for that. The problem is most regions are not actually doing that. We're kind of just doing incremental, year to year, generation project by generation project connection when we're, dealing with the grid, and we don't really have that kind of forward-looking planning. That's the that's the perspective that I have, and that also Americans for a Clean Energy Grid has, is that we should be doing that advanced planning. It's also the perspective that a majority of Federal Energy Regulatory Commission members had when they issued a proposed rule requiring every utility in the country to do that. The only thing is they haven't finalized that. It's kind of hanging a little bit stalled out at FERC right now. Mm-hmm. So we decided in this kind of interim period while we wait for FERC to act to kind of put out this report card and just, you know, level set everybody, obviously try to be as objective as possible, interview lots of people. And so, yeah, it came out. There are a couple regions doing pretty well. I'll mention one is the Midwest, Mid-Continent ISO in the kind of the Great Lakes states, and then down a little bit down into Louisiana area. MISO has historically been a pretty good transmission planner, and they've been able to get alignment from their 13 or so states. And they just recently did another big round of that. That was that seems to be moving forward. So like, that's a good model. And they have a few scenarios they're working through, you know, kind of bigger and bigger scenarios of how much electrification are we going to have and things like that. But they, you know, they did the basic step of, well, what do we think our future generation and retirements are? We don't know down to every specific unit that's going to retire, but we can kind of estimate across the system about how much we'll retire. And then they just did it again, not rocket science, but, you know, they did that. So they got a B. That was, I think they were their highest scoring. Mm-hmm. Couple others were doing pretty well, but most regions are just not even doing that basic step. So there were some Fs and some Ds in the report card, which you know, we try to communicate in sort of like a growth mindset, like everybody can do better here. And you know, the semester isn't over, it's never over. You know, you have plenty of time to fix things and improve. So hopefully
still bring your grade up a little bit, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's even though we're past June, you can send a new report into the teacher and get a better grade over the summer.
There's always time to improve, right?
That's right.
Well, that actually leads us to a great lead into our final question. First off, Rob, thanks for being here. Everyone go check out Grid Strategies and Americans for a Clean Energy Grid, both unique organizations that are doing a lot these days. So Rob, thanks for that first off. But let's say, you know, these utility companies are looking 10, 20 years out. Let's say it's 3 years from now and you're back on our show and you're happy. Things are going good. What has happened in the energy world in general to make you feel happy?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for that, Adam. And I think we could have this conversation in 3 years and I could be happy if each region puts together that type of regional transmission plan. And even better if each region works with their neighbor on an inter-regional plan, like a plan for transmission between the regions. Again, it's not rocket science. There's a lot of people and a lot of money to figure out who's going to pay how much for what. So a lot of tough conversations, but you know, we've done it before. We did a big transmission build out about a decade ago. All the same challenges existed then that exist now. We can overcome those challenges. So let's do that again. It requires, again, a lot of cooperation between states. Sometimes those states have very different views of, you know, climate and clean energy policy and things like that. But those are, you know, those can be incorporated and addressed, and as long as everybody respects others' preferences. So I think we could be there, but that's what I'd like to see is those transmission plans put together. I think there'll be plenty of a role for both independent transmission and utility transmission. There's a lot of ways to do it, but I think we just need to kind of put plans together and get there.
Rob, maybe a quick follow-up to that would be, what does a transmission plan look like? Do we have to build miles and miles and miles of new transmission? Do we need to go through the existing transmission and just upgrade the materials and the lines? Like, what does a transmission plan look like?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, I think first you start with, you know, what can technology do to create some headroom? There's grid enhancing technologies you can plug in. Then you kind of look at the needs. Again, you take the retirements and the additions into account and say, all right, we need power from here to here and there to there. Sometimes it's just an upgraded substation. It's not even any new miles. It's just a new facility that can alleviate a constraint. So when you look at a map of a transmission plan, sometimes it's just more dots rather than lines, but it's some of that. And then there's some little short little links, like let's just connect these two substations. But the other times it's like a 500 or 700 mile line. And it could be an HVDC line instead of a alternating current AC line. So, you know, my guess is a good transmission plan will have some of those different technologies. And also for those lines, you know, they might be high efficiency conductors, the new types of cables compared to the standard. So it's a good mix of technologies used in their appropriate way, short and long distance lines, and then just upgrades on the network, thinking about the network, not just paths, but like the whole network. How does it integrate together?
Well, look, Rob, we appreciate the time you've given us and your leadership on this issue. It is a wildly important issue, I think, as we debate where our energy comes from. We often overlook how does the energy get from point A to point B. So this is something that's critically important for us to keep having conversations like this on, and appreciate your leadership in this space. And thanks for giving us the time today.
Sure thing. Thanks, guys. It was great to be with you.
Well, that wraps up another episode of Let's Clear the Air. Andrew, anything that you take away from that conversation?
I said it probably 3 or 4 times during the course of that conversation, just how underappreciated I think this topic is. And one of the things, you know, when you think about, you know, the added power demand and where it's coming from, you know, you think about EVs, but he mentioned AI. You know, and that, you know, the power draw from data centers, but AI kind of puts that on steroids. And you kind of think about, you know, some of the evolution of data tech, and that was kind of an interesting point that he made. But you know, it's an interesting conversation, and he did a really great job explaining a lot of the questions in an easy to understand manner. What about you, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, the infrastructure in the United States in general just needs more attention. I mean, we have bridges that fail grades, we have utilities that fail grades, we have, you know, all of these things that require maintenance and upkeep, and that has a cost to it. And the grid, you know, whether those of us in the midstream industry or in the renewable industry, it's sort of the veins of our system, right? So you got to be able to get energy from one place to another. And I think the next couple of years or the next decade or so is going to be really interesting to see how much growth or how much maintenance and upkeep there is on those systems. So
it's also interesting that both the infrastructure bill and the IRA didn't really have a whole lot of money to fund transmission infrastructure.
I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah, it's crazy that you wouldn't include that. But, you know, as he mentioned, there's some partisan things going on, I guess. Yeah. So we'll see how it turns out.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, with that, we'd like to hear from our audience on guest suggestions, questions, comments. You can always connect with Andrew and I on LinkedIn. And if you like what you heard, please rate us as your favorite podcast on whichever app you're using to listen to. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Let's Clear the Air.
Thank you for listening to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast with Adam Murray and Dr. Andrew Parker. If you like what you have heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast @gmail.com.